Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC, and while most of the media is obsessing on the entertainment value of Donald Trump's news conference rants or is speculating about how unhinged he is as a result, they are distracted from the real things that are happening at the same time, like this leak to the AP of a purported 100,000 National Guard contingency plan to round up undocumented immigrants. We'll dig into that a little bit more right now and try to understand what the AP is actually reporting. And also that EPA nominee Scott Pruitt is scheduled for a confirmation vote today, but some Democrats are trying to get it delayed because of a court ruling ordering the release of 2,500 emails between Pruitt and fossil fuel companies. We'll talk about that story, too. Here is Pruitt, by way of background, being questioned at his confirmation hearing about his climate views by Senator Bernie Sanders.
Do you believe that climate change is caused by the emission, by carbon emissions, by human activity?
Senator, as I indicated, you weren't in here during my opening statement, but as I indicated in my opening statement, the climate is changing, and the human activity contributes to that in some manner.
In some manner?
Yes, sir.
97% of the scientists who wrote articles in peer-reviewed journals believe that human activity is the fundamental reason we are seeing climate change. You disagree with that?
I believe the ability to measure with precision the degree of human activity's impact on the climate is subject to more debate on whether the climate is changing or whether human activity contributes to it.
So that was Scott Pruitt and Bernie Sanders. And as by way of background, for some of you who hadn't maybe heard Scott Pruitt's voice before even, and that vote could come today over the vehement objections of most Democrats, with a court-ordered email release scheduled for Tuesday, and they want to get a look. We'll talk about this and the underlying environmental issues now, and also touch on this reported executive draft about an immigration National Guard enforcement force. We'll talk about it with a supporter of Pruitt for EPA Administrator, Orrin Kass, an energy expert with the Conservative Manhattan Institute think tank. Some of you may know he was also the policy director for Mitt Romney's campaign in 2012 for president. Hi, Orrin. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me.
Domestic policy director. I just want to get that right. For Mitt Romney in 2012. First, I know you're seeing this for the first time, just as I am, but I'm going to read, since our listeners' interest is no doubt piqued, a little bit more from the AP story that we have to get a little bit of a sense of what they're saying this is or this isn't. And it says, the Trump administration is considering a proposal to mobilize as many as 100,000 National Guard troops to round up unauthorized immigrants, including millions living nowhere near the Mexico border, according to a draft memo obtained by the Associated Press. The 11-page document calls for the unprecedented militarization of immigration enforcement as far north as Portland, Oregon, and as far east as New Orleans, Louisiana. Four states that border on Mexico are included in the proposal: California, Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas. But it also encompasses seven states contiguous to those four: Oregon, Nevada, Utah, Colorado, Oklahoma, Arkansas, and Louisiana. So we can at least say, according to the AP, this wouldn't affect the Northeast, this area. But it continues, while National Guard personnel have been used to assist with immigration-related missions on the U.S.-Mexico border before, they have never been used as broadly or as far north. And I'm skipping over some of this now. It says the draft memo also mentions other items included in Trump's executive order, including the hiring of an additional 5,000 border agents. And according to the draft memo, the militarization effort would be proactive, specifically empowering Guard troops to solely carry out immigration enforcement, not as an add-on the way local law enforcement is used in the program. So, Orrin, what do you make of this? And I guess Sean Spicer is coming out now and denying it.
Well, that's true. I mean, I think this is actually a great opportunity for listeners to kind of put on their critical reading hats as they process this kind of news coming out of the administration. You know, the first question is, what does the draft memo even say? I mean, I think the AP says up to 100,000 National Guard troops. That probably reflects essentially every troop every governor could hypothetically use, not the number anyone's expecting to use. It mentions millions of undocumented immigrants. That's probably the number of immigrants in those states, not the number likely to actually be targeted by the policy, for instance, if they focused on criminals, as the administration has said it will. And then I think the other thing that's critical to recognize is that draft memos circulate constantly in the White House and in any policy organization. And we want that to happen. You know, the contrast is with the original executive order, where I think the White House rightly came under severe criticism because they failed to circulate a draft. People who should have been commenting didn't get to comment, and it came out of nowhere. Well, if you don't do that, if you actually invite people to put forward proposals, circulate them for comments, then this is what happens. Some of them leak, and then people get very excited about them. But it's important to understand that this isn't actually the policy right now, and it probably makes more sense to wait until the White House actually says what it's thinking about doing before reacting too much.
So when the AP story says draft executive order, it's important that people understand what draft means. This could be, a draft. People know what that word means more or less, but it's like a proposal, like somebody on the staff, maybe Bannon or Miller or somebody else might have written up this as, here's something that I'd like you all on the team to consider that maybe we would do. And it gets passed around as just a proposal for discussion. It may be that low in the pipeline.
It could be. And in fact, it's not even a draft executive order. It's a draft memo. So anyone who's worked in any organization mm-hmm. is probably familiar with final memos, let alone draft memos circulating. You know, for all we know, somebody sent out a directive that said, please draft up a bunch of proposals from the most extreme to the most minor so that we can discuss them. And this is one of them.
And so this might be, again, now we're speculating, but we're speculating on something that's pretty shocking if true, and on all we have about it. So
well,
not even
– Yeah, if I could say one please. Thing. You know, based on the AP reporting, it's not even clear whether it's shocking. I mean, if the memo says we are going to mobilize 100,000 troops to round up 2 million people
right. –
that would be shocking. If the order says we are going to allow governors to mobilize guard troops as they see fit to pursue criminal illegal aliens who are already in criminal databases, I think that would frankly not be especially shocking and certainly consistent with everything Trump has indicated throughout his campaign that he would consider.
Would you consider this possibly well, we're getting all kinds of theories from our listeners on Twitter, and listeners tweet away at Brian Lehrer. One is that it's a leak from within the administration as a trial balloon to see how much outrage there is at the idea. Another is that it might actually be fake, but leaked by the administration so that they can catch the AP releasing what seems to be a real document and then accuse them of fake news. Little conspiracy theory there. Or why would this be emerging if it's anywhere in the range of drafts that you were describing?
Well, I think based on the language in the AP article, I think it's safe to assume that it's a leak. And so whether it is intentionally provided by the White House as a trial balloon, provided by someone upset with it who wants to disrupt it, If we're speculating wildly, it could also be an intentional operation by the Trump administration to figure out who's leaking by sending around different memos and seeing which one shows up in the media. I think the first month and all the genuine craziness of the Trump administration has unfortunately locked people into this kind of discussion when it would be much more constructive to focus on what our government is actually doing and what the actual policies are.
And let's make that pivot right now. I think we've digested this AP report that's just come in the last hour as much as we can based on what we know now. My guest is Orrin Kass from the Manhattan Institute think tank, an energy expert primarily. He was also the domestic policy advisor to Mitt Romney in Romney's 2012 presidential campaign. And mostly now we're going to talk about Scott Pruitt, the EPA administrator nominee, with his confirmation vote scheduled for later today. And first, to establish where you're coming from, Orrin, how much of a climate skeptic or a climate denier are you on the basic question of man-made climate change being real and being a serious problem?
Well, I'm not a climate skeptic or a denier at all with respect to man-made climate change being real. I think all policymakers should and policy wonks like myself should start from what the consensus science documents, things like the UN's IPCC report, say. That's a very different question from how large a crisis the problem is and what we should do about it. And on those types of questions, I tend to think that the level of alarm is overstated in some cases, and perhaps most importantly, that the kinds of policies, for instance, that the Obama administration pursued, unfortunately, we're not going to accomplish very much.
That line, that distinction that you make, will strike some people concerned with climate change as the kind of political language that people who don't want to say that they're climate skeptics or deniers might use, but still wind up on the same square, which is to say, yes, it's real, but how much of it of a problem is it really going to become for humanity, and how much of a policy response does it really need to cast a lot of doubt on that?
Well, you know, I think the climate debate has landed in that strange place in part because it unfortunately started as so much of a fight about the science. And so these kinds of language like skeptic and denier are unique, I would say, to the climate debate in part because it's really the one place where everyone was fighting about underlying science. You don't see that much in policy debates. In any other area, what I've just said would strike you as not strange at all. If I said, you know, obviously I think it's a problem that people don't have access to health care, but I don't think that Obamacare is the right solution, that wouldn't seem strange or manipulative or cagey. That would seem like a reasonable, I at least would say, view on healthcare reform. And so I think, you know, one thing that would be of great service and that I'm really pleased to see conservatives moving towards is recognizing that not only is it not constructive or correct to be fighting about a lot of the basic science, but that it's not where the debate should be, that we're, I think, on all sides better off starting from understanding what the science says and then recognizing that we need to take a very critical eye to what policies people are proposing and whether or not they're actually going to do what they say they'll do.
Now, you've written that Scott Pruitt is exactly what the EPA needs because the EPA has fundamentally misunderstood its own role. In fact, you wrote that it's not quite correct to say that the EPA is the protector of the nation's environment. It's not?
Well, you should read the sentence that follows is important too, which is that what it is the enforcer of the EPA's of the nation's environmental laws. And the reality is that something like environmental protection is a difficult and fundamentally political issue. There are a lot of trade-offs about how you're going to balance environmental protection with economic growth, how you're going to balance property rights with community interests, how you're going to balance the state and federal roles. And the EPA as an agency is not supposed to make those decisions. Those are the decisions that Congress is supposed to make as our elected representatives when they pass environmental laws. And the EPA's job is to enforce those laws. And unfortunately, under the Obama administration, I think the attitude became, well, if we don't like what the laws say, we can just go do something else.
That's, of course, where some of the court battles come in. It's really over how to interpret environmental laws passed by Congress, including how broad the authority is under those laws for the EPA to make specific protective rules and regulations. Right?
That's exactly right. And so when you see Scott Pruitt, you know, I think people have said, well, he shouldn't be the EPA administrator because as Oklahoma Attorney General, he was suing the EPA and opposing what the EPA was doing. But in several high-profile cases, he won. The Supreme Court said, actually, what Scott Pruitt says is the EPA's job is correct, and what the EPA says is the EPA's job is incorrect. And so that strikes me as someone very well qualified and who we would be very well served to be helping the EPA now.
But you acknowledge that Scott Pruitt is not an expert in pollution control, so why endorse any EPA administrator who is not an expert in pollution control? Shouldn't they look for one who is, but also has more of a Republican sense of where the balance is with respect to regulation?
Well, you know, I think you have different people with different skill sets, and you can always kind of design in the lab the hypothetical ideal person, but that for almost any cabinet position, what you're ultimately dealing with is looking out at the people who are active and working on policy in the area who would be good candidates. And given that, I think Scott Pruitt is an excellent one. You know, in the past, we've also had EPA administrators with that kind of experience. And just as the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Trump's nominee is a doctor, but, you know, doesn't necessarily need to be a doctor and so on and so forth. You know, historically, the Department of Defense has not been led by a general. You want to find people who are going to pursue the right policy and run the agency well. And I think Scott Pruitt can do that.
Of course, as an elected politician in a fossil fuel state, Oklahoma, Pruitt's repeated lawsuits against the EPA can be seen as crusading for Oklahoma jobs and Oklahoma industry profits, not a balanced approach to environmental costs and benefits, no?
Well, you can see him, I think, proposing a different balance than the one that the federal EPA might have wanted to pursue. As an elected official, you might also say he's pursuing a balance more in line with what the people of his state actually want. And it was interesting, I believe it was 538, which does a lot of data journalism, kind of wrote a very interesting piece about Pruitt that sort of seemed shocked that even with someone who hates the environment as much as Scott Pruitt, actually Oklahoma's environment seemed to be just fine. And of course, there's another way to look at that, which is that Scott Pruitt doesn't hate the environment. He just recognizes that the right environmental policies and the right economic policies as well can strike a much better balance than what the EPA has been doing recently.
I don't know how they measure just fine at 538, but another view on that is there's a New York Times op-ed calling on the Senate to reject Pruitt by Eric Schaefer, former director of the EPA's Office of Civil Enforcement, mostly under President Clinton and a year under George W. Bush. And Schaefer argues that while arguing for states' rights as attorney general, he did little to enforce environmental laws in Oklahoma. He disbanded the Environmental Protection Unit in his own attorney general's office. And the Times cites a state environmental official who retired in 2015 because he was tired of Pruitt standing up for business, quote, at the expense of people who have to drink the water and breathe the air, unquote. So it sounds like he was at least controversial in Oklahoma in this respect.
Well, it sounds like one anonymous retired official felt that he was controversial. You know, there are actually objective ways to measure environmental quality, things like air quality, water quality. And the reality is that the United States has made tremendous gains in those areas across the country compared to even the rest of the developed world, places like Europe, even Western Europe. U.S. has much cleaner air. And what we're really doing, at least in the Obama administration, was taking laws passed in the 1970s when these were real crises and saying, we're just going to keep turning the ratchet. You know, I think air quality has improved 70 or 75% on most major metrics over that time. And so to say, well, actually, that's pretty good. You know, even thinking back 10, 20 years, people in 1990 didn't think our air quality was our country's huge problem. Air quality is much better than it was then, and in Oklahoma as well as everywhere else.
By conventional measures of pollution, the environmental laws of the 70s have been spectacular successes. But this is where I guess you would differ with the more climate change concerned folks, which is that they're arguing that that is a real crisis. And so we are in a crisis situation, and the courts have already given the federal government the ability to regulate climate polluting emissions, you know, in the ways that they regulate old-fashioned pollution, pollution and pollutants, right, that make the air gray and things like that. So whether there's a crisis or not, well, I guess that's part of the dispute.
Well, it is an interesting question how climate fits into that picture. I think the court has in some limited ways said that you can try to regulate carbon dioxide the same way you regulate pollutants. The problem is that that turns out to work exceptionally poorly, both because everything is a source of carbon dioxide and because the concentrations in our air are not a function of what we do here. They're a function of activity around the world. So what the Obama administration actually did and the reason it got sued was that instead of regulating carbon dioxide the way the law says to regulate things, it first put in place what's called a tailoring rule, which said we're just going to ignore all the sources that we realize it would be insane to apply the law to. even while pretending the law still should be applied. And then we're going to go use a different provision that's not about the main pollutants to impose what they call the Clean Power Plan, which is essentially telling every state how much carbon dioxide it can emit. And so that's what Scott Pruitt, one of the things Scott Pruitt sued over, that's what the Supreme Court, first time ever, put a stay in place saying this is frankly so egregious that we're not even going to wait until the D.C. Circuit has ruled on it to tell the EPA, stop what you're doing, stop moving forward. And that's what we can't have happening.
The court ruling yesterday, by Tuesday, the Oklahoma Attorney General's office, Pruitt's old office, is supposed to release 250,000 emails between Pruitt and the Koch brothers company and other fossil fuels companies. But the confirmation vote could come today. It's scheduled for today. There's already a story about Pruitt taking language from a fossil fuels company and just cutting and pasting it into one piece of Oklahoma state policy. Why shouldn't they wait to see if this email trove reveals more relevant information about how much of a tool of industry rather than an objective law enforcer he's been?
Well, I think, and I may not be familiar with all of the stories, I believe what Pruitt was accused of doing and did do as attorney general was not paste fossil fuel language into law. He pasted it into a letter. In other words, the
that's correct.
That the group said essentially, we need this message to be sent to Washington. Please send it. And Pruitt did that. And I would say on the one hand that was not well advised, that he should have rewritten it. But on the other hand, that in substance, that's no different than what state officials of all sorts do all the time when constituents, whether they be corporations or individuals, come in and they are persuaded of the position. So, you know, I think at the end of the day, the question with Pruitt is one of policy. I think people understand what policy he would pursue. It's the policy that Trump campaigned on pursuing. It's frankly the policy all Republicans, for the most part, have campaigned on for years. And it's one that currently has support in the House, in the Senate, and now the White House. And if that's the person who Donald Trump would like to have lead the EPA, then I think it's appropriate to confirm him.
Well, what policy is that, or set of policies with respect to climate change? Trump ran saying, you know, climate change is a Chinese hoax, and then he took Chinese out of it. And then he said, well, maybe it's not a hoax after the election, and told the Times, maybe I'll stay in the Paris Accord. But there's no policy attached to Donald Trump that I know of. So what would you, as an energy expert very steeped in this, for the Manhattan Institute, what would you actually have the government do about climate change?
Yeah, I think you're certainly right to characterize the president's climate policy as non-existent or maybe too existent. You can find every position. You know, I think the biggest problem with the way that we think about climate policy is that we've come to think of it as a domestic policy issue, that this is something we can fix if only we pass this law or that law. And the reality is that overwhelmingly it's a foreign policy issue, that about, you know, 80%+ of emissions expected to occur over the coming century are going to come in the developing world. Most of the rest will come from other developed countries. But
that's what the Paris Accord is, right? The recognition that the U.S. and China are the two outsized carbon emitters right now, that other countries want to have economic growth, industrial development, which would make them bigger carbon emitters than they are right now, and other greenhouse gases. And so that's the framework for regulating how quickly they can grow and how much we're going to help them with payments to grow through renewable energy sources rather than the same ones that we originally grew through, all of that stuff. That's what Paris is a foreign policy approach. So do you support it?
Well, I think what you've described is what people say Paris is. The problem is it's not what Paris is. What Paris is a voluntary process where they said, instead of actually locking in an agreement that's going to force everybody to do something about their emissions, we're going to voluntarily allow everybody to submit any pledge they want of any sort they want, and we will automatically accept them all and then have a big signing ceremony and photo op. And if you actually go through what countries, particularly developing countries, committed, they to a country committed only to doing what analysts expected was going to happen anyway. So China only said, well, we'll stop growing our emissions by 2030. well, U.S. government studies, other studies said that's going to happen regardless as their economy matures. India actually committed to progress that's slower than the progress that it was already naturally making in recent years. You go through the other major developing countries. Pakistan is my favorite. All they said was they pledged to peak their emissions at some point after which they will begin reducing. Well, that is, they have provided a definition of the word peak, but that's it. And so I think, you know, the right way to understand what happened in Paris in part is an Obama administration cashing in on a political opportunity at the expense of actual progress, but also really a confirmation that this is how these countries intend to move forward, that they plan to prioritize economic growth over the climate issue. And as long as that's their choice, and as long as we don't plan to coerce them and embargo them or fight them over it, really our policy tools are pretty limited, unfortunately.
Oren Kass, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, where he focuses on energy and the environment as well as anti-poverty policy. He was Mitt Romney's chief domestic policy advisor during the 2012 campaign. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay with us.